The handout that Jimmy passed out is sort of a conglomeration of things that I've put together from a number of different sources. One of the things that we've been doing in the Sunday school class that I'm in is the evangelism class. And we've been looking at some material put together by a group called Stand to Reason, Greg Kuchel. And what he has done is given some strategies and tactics for helping Christians be able to engage in conversations with people, primarily by using questions. And he shows the tactical advantage of doing that, how it can get you out of the hot seat, so to speak, when you're in a difficult conversation, or if you're in a classroom, reverse the burden of proof, because the person who's is the person who to defend those claims. And so if you're not the ones making the assertions and other people are, then it's up to them to defend those. And a lot of times, and in particular in this issue of creation evolution, it might be a good strategy for us to let the person who seems to want to advocate evolution, neo-Darwinism, something like that, let them take the floor and try to defend their position. And the best way to do that is by asking some really good questions. Somebody comes up to you and says, evolution's a fact. You know, you creationists are just ridiculous. Stuff is a fact. I say, well, what do you mean by that? And then make them explain what they mean by the claim evolution is a fact. Maybe they're talking about some aspect of evolution that we agree with, that we don't dispute. And then we can say, well, I agree with that. You know, if they describe natural selection from the standpoint of what's actually observed in the real world, you know, a cat has kittens and one that's born deformed gets eliminated so that that deformity doesn't get spread further through the subsequent generations. That's natural selection in a sense, and we don't dispute that. What we dispute is the larger claims that natural selection coupled with mutations can actually produce something beyond cats becoming something else, all the way from microbes to people, that macro mutation or macro evolutionary scenario that makes much bigger claims that are not observed. So asking that question, you know, what do you mean by that, can be a very good strategy. And then if they give an answer, you can follow with another question. You can say, well, how did you come to have that? You know, how did you come to believe that? Why do you believe that? Make them explain themselves after they give you, you know, something in response to your first question. So there's a lot more to it, but that's one of the things we've been doing in our Sunday school class. And I thought, as I try to think of how we could deal with a single Sunday school lesson that could, you know, critique neo-Darwinism, I thought, well, that's kind of ambitious. So I thought maybe we could just work through some questions that you could think through. Jonathan Wells is a intelligent design scientist. He's a biologist. And on the Access Research Network website, this 10 questions to ask your biology teacher about evolution was a nice little example of using questions. And I thought, well, maybe we can use that as our outline and maybe work through as much of that as we can. He's dealing with it from the standpoint of biology textbooks. And I just did something like this with the junior high class, where we looked at a standard biology textbook. And I think some of the young people here at our church use this textbook. This is the Glencoe textbook, so they're using this in Hillsborough. Number of students that are down there, but I think the people here at Eastern are using the same biology textbook. And so if you go through that and look at their evidence for evolution, a lot of it will be right in line with what Jonathan Wells is trying to ask questions about. In other words, he's picked out what he believes are extremely vulnerable places where it would be good to ask a question of an evolutionist, because they're weak areas. So if you can, we'll go through these, and I'll try to provide some background information or further explanation to why he's asked this question. But if you can learn to explore these areas, you will be sort of beefing up your arsenal to be able to ask questions in important areas, because these are the weak areas of neo-Darwinism. Steve? Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not going to get really complicated, but whenever Darwin proposed his mechanism of natural selection, he didn't know anything about how genetics really works, Mendelian genetics, and so as science has progressed and population genetics and statistical analysis of things and a better understanding of genetics has happened, there's been a synthesis of all those different areas of scientific, you know, advancement. And so the neo-Darwinian synthesis or neo-Darwinism, I think at the time around the 1950s when Julian Huxley was around and Ernst Mayr at Harvard and a number of these people put together all these lines of evidence to come up with what now gets referred to as neo-Darwinism. But it's basically just the modern version that couples Mendelian genetics with natural selection as the basis for explaining the diversity of all of life. So it's just the modern form of evolution. Natural selection, mutations. Those are the two main things. And there are some other mechanisms that they also throw in there from time to time to try to help round out the theory. And, of course, we're simplifying it. But those are the big components of it, is mutations providing the variability and then natural selection providing the engine to drive it on to ever increasingly more complex things until we go from microbes to people. So, and please, you know, ask questions as we go, because, again, that's what I thought would be the most helpful, is to use this class to help us in a practical way get to where we can know about some of the vulnerable areas in neo-Darwinism or Darwinism, evolution, and then be able to ask those questions of other people if we happen to run into somebody who's making claims or trying to, you know, kind of make fun of the creation position or the intelligent design position. So let's begin by looking at his first one. Why don't I have, just so that it's not me talking the whole time, why don't I have each one of you, we'll just go down the row here, and someone can read the question. And then I'll try to provide some further background or explanation as to why that is an important question or good question. Ms. Christoph, you want to start? And we'll just work down the road. All right. Origin of life. Now, I'm no biochemist. Maybe we should get Ken James to come in here and talk about that issue. But because, as a matter of fact, if you ever have questions about origin of life, you should talk to Ken James, because he's an expert on that. That was really where he focused his research when he was in graduate school, was on the issues dealing with that. So he would be an expert in that area. But I can tell you some things about this that will help you. And again, this is a particularly important area because the evolutionists have tried for about the last 50 years, coming at it from a number of different ways, to try to make some, to gain some ground in this area. And they've been extremely unsuccessful in this area. So now one of the strategies they use, and if you go to any of these evolution defending websites like the one provided by the National Center for Science Education, which is an organization that exists to promote evolution and to defeat creation wherever it may show its ugly head. You know, that's what they do. That's their purpose of existing, is to fight creationism. And so on their website, you know, they put all the court cases that are going on, all the school board situations are going on, and they provide strategies for people, you know, to go in and infiltrate those meetings and make sure that creation doesn't get a chance to be heard. Well, one of the strategies that they advocate teachers take in dealing with the origin of life is to separate it, to say this isn't even part of neo-Darwinism. This isn't part of evolution, so don't let them get you sidetracked on that, because that's a different issue. It's a separate issue. They don't want to talk about it, in other words. Well, why do they not want to talk about it? Because they realize that if you can't even get the ball rolling with life at the very beginning, naturalistically, well, then you're in a heap of trouble being able to explain all of diversity of life naturalistically with no help from outside, with a God, help from God or anything. And that's what they want to do. They want to explain everything naturalistically. But they're having a very difficult time doing that at the very beginning, just with the first simplest cell, you know, with the first little piece of DNA that supposedly could form naturalistically by chemical processes, just natural chemical laws, bringing together that first piece of RNA or DNA or the first protocell or living cell. They haven't been able to demonstrate it in the lab. With all of their sophisticated technology, all of their intelligence, and all of their billions and billions of dollars of research spent trying to do so, they haven't been able to do that. So this is a very important thing. Now, this 1953 Miller-Urey experiment, it's in this textbook. They have pictures of it and several, they have a little expose of Stanley Miller and everything, and they put it in there and make it sound like something really important happened and something very successful happened, you know, because this Russian scientist named Oparin developed this idea that there was this, you know, the early atmosphere of the Earth didn't have the same components as the atmosphere today. There was no free oxygen. There was only things like methane and ammonia and nitrogen, water vapor. And then perhaps there were, you know, electrical discharges from lightning, maybe some heat, solar radiation, those types of energy. And in that environment, which is what Stanley Miller and Harold Urey tried to mimic in their laboratory experiment, was those same conditions. So they took out all the oxygen and put, you know, methane, ammonia, ran them through this little glass apparatus where they subjected it to electrical discharge and so forth, and they hit a little trap at the bottom where they got the products out that it produced. And it produced some simple amino acids, a very few simple amino acids. Well, amino acids are the building blocks for proteins. So they said, wow, we got the building blocks for proteins. Were the first steps for on our way to developing life. And that was the claim, and that was the, you know, the hoopla, and what they were so excited about is they thought they had almost, you know, got something here on their way to explaining how what Oparin had said could have happened in the early Earth. The problem is that, like this question says, the conditions of the early Earth were probably nothing like those used in the experiment. And that's derived from looking at things geologically. When you look at the rocks that they claim to be the earliest rocks at the time of the Earth's formation, or some of the oldest rocks that are available on the Earth, when they study those, they are oxidized type things, things that look like oxygen was present. It's always been present. So they have to explain that away, because the evidence is saying there was oxygen present. But the problem is if you've got oxygen, free oxygen present, like what we have in the present, any kind of forming molecules, biologically important molecules, would be oxidized and destroyed in the presence of oxygen. So you can't have oxygen at the beginning, but the evidence looks like there was oxygen present. So that's one of the problems. The other problem is if there's no oxygen, then that means there couldn't be any ozone, because ozone is produced by solar radiation hitting, you know, diatomic oxygen, O2, converting it into O3, which is triatomic oxygen or ozone. But if you don't have any oxygen, you don't get ozone. If you don't have any ozone, you have no protection against the cosmic radiation or the solar radiation penetrating Earth. And so when you've got UV radiation beaming in with no protection, whatever molecules would be being formed would be destroyed immediately. Okay? Just like your skin gets destroyed by UV radiation. If you sit out in it, you don't protect yourself. So they've got kind of a catch-22. If there was oxygen, then the molecules supposedly being formed would be destroyed by oxidation. If you don't have oxygen, then you don't get any ozone formed, so there's no protective layer, so solar radiation destroys them. So both ways, either way you want to take it, they have problems with that early Earth atmosphere. And then on top of that, the actual geologic evidence seems to be indicating that there has always been a large amount of oxygen present. So that's one thing. Second thing that this question is trying to point out is that that experiment, if you look at it and think about it, what Miller and Urey did with their apparatus is they were aware of this problem with the destructive tendency of that energy pouring in on their products. And so they trapped those products that they were from, those amino acids that had formed by subjecting it to this discharge. As soon as they did, they pulled them out of the system with a little trap in their system so that they could no longer be subjected to that energy. Because if they were, they would be destroyed. And so his experiment doesn't really mimic the early Earth conditions, because the early Earth wouldn't have had a trap to remove those products that were forming. They would just keep sitting there, receiving that energy and being destroyed. So they would never develop further. They would simply be destroyed. The raw energy that's pouring in, hitting those things, causes a destruction of the molecules at a much higher rate than any kind of formation rate. So that's another major problem with that Miller-Urey experiment. Now, they're still, you know, again, this is the way science operates. They're very confident that because they got something, you know, and they made some achievement, that's all that you need. When you already believe that evolution is true, when you're already convinced of it, when you have a naturalistic viewpoint that means something like that had to happen anyway, it doesn't really matter how good the evidence is. You just need anything. And that's what Miller-Urey's experiment did. It gave them something. So what we're doing is we're going back and we're pointing out the flaws in it, the problems with it, which they totally gloss over and don't even consider, but they're major, major problems. And that's what we need to try to become aware of so that we can point those out by asking those kinds of questions of people. There's some other problems. Let me read you a quote. This is kind of a lengthy quote, but I think it's important because they never say this in the textbooks. And they make it sound like it's so simple to just form these building blocks, these amino acids and proteins and protocells and the first living cell. They make it sound like it's almost inevitable. It just would have happened. But I want to read you a quote. This is like a third problem. Because in an evolutionary scenario for the origin of life, there would be an incredible clutter or a messy situation that would be formed. If you're just dealing with naturalistic products that just form, you're not going to get pure amino acids like what you would start out with in a laboratory experiment, or the perfect little energy levels provided at just the right sequence at the right time. What you would get is this big chaotic mess of all kinds of things fighting against each other, competing for stuff, and that messy situation is never replicated in their experiments. They don't just put all these different components together and zap it with energy and see what will happen, because they know they wouldn't get anything that would be useful towards their scenario of explaining the origin of life. So that's what this quote sort of explains. So try to follow it. It's going to be kind of lengthy, but I think it explains this point very well. This is a quote by a biochemist, Dr. Dwayne Gish. And he says, suppose that there was, like the evolutionists assume, a way for biologically important molecules to have formed in a significant quantity on a primitive Earth. An incredible, messy, and chaotic mix of all kinds of chemical products and components would be randomly swimming together. He says, in addition to the 20 different amino acids found in proteins today, hundreds of other kinds of amino acids would have been produced. In addition to the deoxyribose and ribose, the five carbon sugars found in DNA and RNA today, a variety of other five carbon sugars, four carbon, six carbon, and seven carbon sugars would have been produced. In addition to the five purines and pyrimidines found in DNA and RNA today, a great variety of other purines and pyrimidines would exist. Further, of vital significance, the amino acids in proteins today are exclusively left-handed. That means that when you run plane polarized light through them, they spin in a certain direction. Or they make light, and so they're called left-handed or right-handed. All amino acids on the primitive Earth would be 50% left-handed and 50% right-handed. That's what you get. Statistically, when you just do things from a natural standpoint, you get 50% of each mixed together. You don't get one or the other. But in proteins, you've got to have just one, and if you the wrong ones in there, it destroys the biological capability.
Therefore, that cell dating with a organically produce molecules, and it was a good antihistamine. But they found with grapefruit juice, it was killing them. Well, they got rid of the right-handed molecule, and the cells and the leg are safe.
But in the naturalistic world, you get 50% of each. The sugars in DNA and RNA today are exclusively right-handed, but if they did exist, sugars on a primitive Earth would have been 50% right-handed and 50% left-handed. If just one right-handed amino acid is in a protein, or just one left-handed sugar is found in DNA or RNA, all biological activity is destroyed. There would be no mechanism available on a primitive Earth to select the correct form. This fact alone destroys evolution. Evolutionists have been wrestling with this dilemma since it was first recognized, and there is no solution in sight. All of these many varieties would compete with one another in a great variety of other organic molecules, including aldehydes, ketones, acids, amines, lipids, carbohydrates, etc. So then, there you see it. It's a complicated mess. It's what you would really get if you were trying to replicate the early Earth situation, which they don't. They come up with this much more narrow focus, which allows them to come up, you know, to successfully produce a few amino acids using the purest situation, laboratory conditions that do not mimic a real early Earth situation. And then they claim success. Then they claim, oh, we've shown how this could happen. When really, they haven't really shown how it could happen, because it could never have happened like that in the early Earth. I'm going to move on from the origin of life because we're using a lot of time there. But again, if you avail yourself of some of the DVDs that are available, or go to some of these websites and read up on some of this stuff. This is a very important area because, like I said, they've been notoriously unsuccessful in this area, and to the point where they're trying to avoid it. They're trying to distance it from evolution itself. And so that's our clue. Okay, I need to go learn something about that because they're obviously having problems there. So let me go get some information about that issue.